You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 11th of December, 2025, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, it's Thursday, and that means we have with us today geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, better than I was. I am joined by Stanley the Manly, my big orange cat who guards me at all times, although he's snoring right now. Other than that, things are going well.
Well, it's good that he's snoring and not making any other noises. You warned us about the cat last week, and he was actually very well behaved. We didn't hear from him at all. Hopefully, it will be the same this week. Well, this week, we're going to be talking about the Trump administration's 2025 national security strategy. And after reading through this the other day, I didn't really have any feelings on it, either positive or negative. It just seemed, I guess it wasn't really telling the whole truth. So I'm hoping you're going to be able to explain what they're actually talking about here, Matt, because it just didn't seem that controversial to me. It seemed fairly predictable. So we've got a truncated version of the national security strategy. We'll start with the introduction. After the end of the Cold War, American foreign policy elites convinced themselves that permanent American domination of the entire world was in the best interests of our country. Yet the affairs of other countries are our concern only if their activities directly threaten our interests. Our elites badly miscalculated America's willingness to shoulder forever global burdens to which the American people saw no connection to the national interest. They overestimated America's ability to fund, simultaneously, a massive welfare regulatory administrative state alongside a massive military, diplomatic, intelligence and foreign aid complex. They placed hugely misguided and destructive bets on globalism and so-called free trade that hollowed out the very middle class and industrial base on which American economic and military preeminence depend. They allowed allies and partners to offload the cost of their defence onto the American people and sometimes to suck us into conflicts and controversies central to their interests but peripheral or irrelevant to our own. And they lashed American policy to a network of international institutions, some of which are driven by outright anti-Americanism and many by a transnationalism that explicitly seeks to dissolve individual state sovereignty. In sum, not only did our elites pursue a fundamentally undesirable and impossible goal, in doing so they undermined the very means necessary to achieve that goal, the character of our nation upon which its power, wealth, and decency were built. Now, on the surface, I agree with all that, to be honest. It's quite a sensible thing that he's actually saying there. But this anti-Americanism, I think, may well be anti-Israel. And when he talks about America getting dragged into conflicts, it seems to be Israel that drags America into these conflicts. And I know that he's certainly not talking about Israel doing this. So I guess maybe he's referring to Ukraine there. And again, that's fairly honest of him to say that they got dragged into it in Ukraine due to the American elites that came before him. So I'm not against this introduction at all, really, Matt. I think he's been quite honest there, but he's also trying to put the best spin on it by saying that all the rest of the world look to America for defense, because the argument from the rest of the world is, oh yes, but you've put all your bases in our country and we have to obey your laws. It's like we're occupied by America because we've got all your defense bases here and we have to obey your laws. That's why we're not so interested in paying for our defence, because we see it as an occupation rather than as a defence. So there's two ways to look at these American foreign bases. But those are my thoughts on this, Matt. What are yours?
Well, you got to remember, this is written in diplomatic language. It's really, you know, he uses a lot of abstractions. If any of this is going to be implemented, you know, he needs to get rid of people like Rubio. You know, there are still plenty of neocons in this administration. He has demand now in European circles. I've been reading it just before we came on the air. This has caused a huge stir because he's demanding they increase their military budgets, and at the same time protect themselves from mass immigration. And European elites are going crazy here, saying, how dare you criticize our immigration policy? And in other speeches and other things, he's gone even deeper into this stuff. He's right in many things. But let me quote you something that's not in what I've sent to you. He says, in the Declaration of Independence, America's founders laid down a clear preference for non-interventionism in the affairs of other nations and made clear the basis. Just as all human beings possess God-given natural rights, all nations are entitled by the laws of nature and nature's God to a separate and equal station with respect to one another. For a country whose interests are as numerous and diverse as ours, rigid adherence to non-interventionism is just not possible. Yet this predisposition should set a very high bar for what constitutes a justified intervention. Now, that's his reinterpretation of the America First ideology. And we'll see as we go along, there's plenty of areas where he demands, well, not demands, but lays the path open for intervention. It is this, you know, we agree with a lot of this, but for a country whose interests are as numerous and diverse as ours, in other words, that statement negates everything else. And he uses quite a bit of abstraction. We know what he's really talking about, but he just doesn't say it. So the basic concept is that there should be a very, very high bar for what constitutes justified intervention. And there's no question that Israel, under all circumstances, is over that bar. You know, he has a lot of assumptions in here about the military power of the United States, which is not as strong as he thinks. The success of his attack on Iran, which was an absolute failure. But the fact that he is demanding more of the Europeans while at the same time saying that they should close their borders too has created this, you know, it's almost like European leaders don't know what to do with themselves. And either, you know, this week or next week, we'll get to the part where he starts talking about European policy and what they have to do. Some of the stuff he says here can get you sent to prison in the UK or elsewhere. But, you know, it's just pure projection when he says sometimes suck us into conflicts and controversies central to their interests, but peripheral or irrelevant to our own. Israel is, of course, the ultimate culprit there. But that doesn't equate to him. It doesn't mean anything to him. It is absolutely true, though. But if he keeps people like Rubio around, then I don't know how this is really going to be followed. So it's great on paper, but it's very abstract. And we'll see. He adds some more detail as it goes on.
Well, I was quite disappointed that he didn't actually make more mention of mass immigration and the threat to free speech, because at the European Security Conference, or the NATO Security Conference, shortly after he took office, J.D. Vance gave that fantastic speech, which was saying that the actual threat comes within the European countries, and the threat is caused by mass immigration and the response to mass immigration, which is to censor all the citizens. And if you don't have free speech, you don't have democracy. You can't literally cannot call it a democracy if people are not allowed to voice their opinions and voice their thoughts and vote for the people that they want to vote for. In a lot of European countries, they literally just shut down political parties and lock people up and threaten them. So I would have liked to have seen much more talk about that. I couldn't find any of it in here. But I guess, it is talking about American national security, but peripheral to that is the security within Europe, which I think he quite rightly said is threatened by mass immigration and also the mass censorship that we have in Europe. Well, the second part is, what do we want in and from the world? And they're bullet points. He says, we want to ensure that the Western Hemisphere remains reasonably stable and well-governed enough to prevent and discourage mass migration to the United States. We want a hemisphere whose governments cooperate with us against narco-terrorists, cartels, and other transnational criminal organizations. We want a hemisphere that remains free of hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets and that supports critical supply chains. And we want to ensure our continued access to key strategic locations. In other words, we will assert and enforce a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. And, you know, I agree with all that. And we shouldn't have foreign ownership, particularly of important parts of our infrastructure, like electricity, power stations, water supply. We shouldn't have foreign ownership of that. Not just hostile foreign ownership, but any foreign ownership. We should never have sold off our national inheritance in the way that we did. So I agree with all of this, but what causes the mass migration is a lot of the time has been United States attacks on places like Syria, on Afghanistan, on Iraq. That's been a lot of the cause of the mass migration. The ones that we're told are legal, the legal refugees, they came from Syria and Afghanistan. And it was America and Britain who went in there and bombed the place. And that's what caused all these refugees. It's not that Europe needs to prevent them coming into the United States. If America hadn't bombed those countries in the first place, I don't think we would have half the refugee problem that we actually have. Matt, what do you make of this? And what does he mean by a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine?
Well, it's just, you know, he's worried about what it comes down to is Chinese and Russian influence in South America. He struggles with the idea that the U.S. Is now second in the world in economic power to China. And there's been, you know, plenty of Chinese investment in the area, which he claims is totally wrong. And yet that interferes with his conception of nationalism. The only reason that it's hostile is that the U.S. has made them hostile. As far as migration, I think a huge chunk of it is the benefits that they get when they get here. I don't think it's, you know, looking for a better life or anything like that. I think benefits is the main thing. But, you know, as far as the Europeans are concerned, now this is about the Western Hemisphere, but, you know, as far as the Europeans are concerned, this massive influx since, 2010 or 2011, the beginning of the Syrian war, there have been huge wars in this area for a very long time that never led to mass migration to Europe. And I think we all know that there are NGOs and other groups that go down there and recruit them. They're going to be cheap labor. They're going to be used against the majority population whenever we get too uppity. So this is really what the issue is. Narco-terrorists, well, you know, he just pardoned one, former president of Honduras. And yet he says something like this. I have no problem with declaring the cartels terrorists. He's right to do that. They actually are. But in Venezuela, which of course is you know looms very large in here. But Venezuela doesn't have any, so they need to invent them. Now, I'm not sure also what he means by key assets, critical supply chains as far as the U.S. is concerned. You know, this has everything to do with migration. And because South America is so close and is so dependent on the Americans, the U.S., sanctions actually work there to some extent. So going to other countries is a necessity. And that's been a regular, you know, yet the U.S. does it all over, you know, Eastern Europe and Central Asia, surrounding Russia and China with bases and trying to get their hands on key assets, which they fail to do to a great extent. So this is, American exceptionalism is built into this. This hypocrisy, this projection is built into this. Yeah, in the abstract, and he is writing in very much in the abstract, of course. It all makes sense to me. But this has to be made into policy. And so far, I'm not seeing it.
Well, perhaps when he's talking about these key assets, maybe he's talking about things such as 5G, which, if I remember right, had something to do with Huawei. And there was a big thing with Huawei a few years back, and they had contracts taken off them. So I should imagine there is a lot of Chinese investment in the technological areas, which I think he would be talking of as key assets. I know that they are involved in Britain, probably also involved in America. Continuing, he says, we want to halt and reverse the ongoing damage that foreign actors inflict on the American economy while keeping the Indo-Pacific free and open, preserving freedom of navigation in all crucial sea lanes, and maintaining secure and reliable supply chains and access to critical materials. We want to support our allies in preserving the freedom and security of Europe while restoring Europe's civilizational self-confidence and Western identity. We want to prevent an adversarial power from dominating the Middle East, its oil and gas supplies, and the choke points through which they pass while avoiding the forever wars that bogged us down in that region at great cost. And we want to ensure that US technology and US standards, particularly in AI, biotech, and quantum computing, drive the world forward. These are the United States' core, vital, national interests. While we also have others, these are the interests we must focus on above all others, and that we ignore or neglect at our peril. And I'd say that, you know, they are good points. You don't want choke points where people can cut off your oil and gas supplies. You don't want these foreign wars that have gone on and on and on. And it is important to restore Europe's Western identity. I'm sure the European countries are furious about that, that being told that they need to have their civilizational self-confidence restored along with their Western identity. So I can't see any real issues with this part of the doctrine. What do you make of what he says here, Matt?
Well, there's a lot here. Again, he uses a tremendous amount of abstraction. He then moves to the Indo-Pacific region. He's talking about the South China Sea, and which is another area where he accepts full intervention. China has no interest in eliminating freedom of navigation. They benefit from it. They're an export-driven economy. Only, of course, the U.S. is very hostile, put sanctions on them. It's got a different story. You know, but I love the point about civilizational self-confidence and identity. And I know that's led to a huge furor in Europe. I've been reading about it just before we came on. An adversarial power in the Middle East. He's talking about Iran. To a lesser extent, he's talking about Russia. But even there, and they used that argument back in the early 90s against Saddam Hussein. If you have an oil-dependent export economy, why would you shut it down? The only reason you would shut it down is if you're under attack yourself. And any of these forms of intervention are going to be forever wars. You know, so he's contradicted himself many times here. And to some extent, you know, this whole thing, he's he reduces global politics to economics, which is not necessarily a terrible thing. That the only thing that really matters is the American standard of living, the American economic interests. And the political stuff is secondary. And if a policy raises American living standards, it's fine. If it doesn't, we have a problem with it. So he's not wrong with any of this, but he uses this abstract language. But we really know what he's talking about. And he's laying open many areas for intervention. We know he wants war with China, which is kind of the Republican idea, move away from Russia, move over to China, which is going to be the U.S. is going to be destroyed if they try to take on the Chinese, which I don't think they're going to do. I think they'll use proxies like they do in Ukraine. But and frankly, the supplies for any kind of warfare simply aren't there. The merchant marine isn't there. So all of this stuff, this is kind of old Republican Party pablum from many years ago. And they're half truths. He just forgets to mention that the only reason that these things may be threats are that that the U.S. has essentially declared war on these areas. And self-confidence and identity, that comes up. I know the former prime minister of Sweden called Trump a fascist for that sentence. That's a huge part of it, because apparently the European economic future has to do with all of these low wage workers coming in from the third world, which all of a sudden have become an issue over the last 10 years. So he's not incorrect. It's just not the whole truth.
Well, moving forward, he next talks about China. Economics, the ultimate stakes, China. Going forward, we will rebalance America's economic relationship with China, prioritizing reciprocity and fairness to restore American economic independence. Trade with China should be balanced and focused on non-sensitive factors. If America remains on a growth path and can sustain that while maintaining a genuinely mutually advantageous economic relationship with Beijing, we should be headed from our present $30 trillion economy in 2025 to $40 trillion in the 2030s, putting our country in an enviable position to maintain our status as the world's leading economy. Our ultimate goal is to lay the foundation for long-term economic vitality. Importantly, this must be accompanied by a robust and ongoing focus on deterrence to prevent war in the Indo-Pacific. This combined approach can become a virtuous cycle as strong American deterrence opens up space for more disciplined economic action, while more disciplined economic action leads to greater American resources to sustain deterrence in the long term. To accomplish this, several things are essential. First, the United States must protect and defend our economy and our people from harm from any country or source. And this means ending, among other things, predatory state-directed subsidies and industrial strategies, unfair trading practices, job destruction and deindustrialization, grand-scale intellectual property theft and industrial espionage, threats against our supply chains that risk U.S. access to critical resources, including minerals and rare earth elements, exports of fentanyl precursors that fuel America's opioid epidemic, and propaganda influence operations and other forms of cultural subversion. The United States must work with our treaty allies and partners, who together add another $35 trillion in economic power to our own $30 trillion national economy, together constituting more than half the world economy, to counteract predatory economic practices and use our combined economic power to help safeguard our prime position in the world economy and ensure that allied economies do not become subordinate to any competing power. And I'm guessing that what he means by predatory economic practices is China being a nationalist country. Therefore, they have a lot to do with the economy and they help their corporations out. And I'm also not sure what he means by preventing war in the Indochina Seas. I mean, what countries are likely to be at war there? There might be some skirmishes between China and India up in the Himalayas where they contest certain bits of land up there. But I can't see there actually being any open warfare going on between China and anyone else. I mean, what are they talking about there, Matt? Are they talking about Taiwan there by any chance, do you think?
Well, Taiwan is you know, you have to figure out what they have in mind. Clearly, they're talking about China. And we know that because these accusations have been thrown against China for many years, especially by Republicans. China is a social nationalist country. I have a book, which is another project I have to get going on, that proves that. It's not a communist country by any means, but it's firmly nationalist. There is no planning in the Leninist sense, but there's a direction into what areas China can dominate. Not to mention the fact that most of the American trade deficit, with a huge chunk of it, I should say, come from American companies moving to China and having that, and then using that cheap labor and having it exported to the U.S. So I've been to enough Trump rallies, and I've heard him say that the Chinese deindustrialized America, as if they came in and stole these firms. No, it's American companies who were given subsidies to move out there. It comes down to this: many actors, not just Republicans, but many actors, can't handle the fact that the U.S. is in decline, and so they come up with any accusation they can. Say, well, it's just because they're treating us unfairly. That's it. Rather than that their economy is better and is run better and they're more prosperous. The accusation about fentanyl precursors, now that's a new one, which could, by the way, those precursors, I've looked them up, they could be used for many things, not just that. And that's kind of it's been a more recent accusation. There's plenty of American firms that these are highly scheduled chemicals. But the propaganda influence operations, you know, all throughout this document, I think maybe five times, Trump mentions American soft power. In other words, our own influence operations abroad. So, you know, he can't have it both ways here. Cultural subversion. Well, I don't know what he's referring to. I mean, the U.S. is the ultimate cultural subverter. You have a tremendous amount of projection here. So this myth that he has this idea, it's going to be a $40 trillion economy in the 2030s. I don't see that happening. Rebalancing America's relationship with China. Well, he's trying to get rid of the trade deficit, but doesn't understand why the trade deficit exists in the first place. You know, the U.S. is deindustrialized. It's not really a first world power anymore. And because a trade deficit results from that, he thinks it's unfair. And the U.S. is not the world's leading economy. We have to get that straight. If you use purchasing power parity, which is the only accurate way to measure economies, China is number one and has been number one for a while now. And unlike the U.S., actually makes things. So this deterrence, I can only assume he means, you know, bases all over the place there, which we know exist, constantly goading the Chinese in their own backyard. So apparently China can't have a Monroe Doctrine, only the U.S. can. So this is kind of the American exceptionalism idea that's really throughout this entire document that I'm not so sure the authors are consciously aware of.
Well, next he moves on to promoting European greatness. It is a core interest of the United States to negotiate an expeditious cessation of hostilities in Ukraine in order to stabilize European economies, prevent unintended escalation or expansion of the war, and re-establish strategic stability with Russia, as well as to enable the post-hostilities reconstruction of Ukraine to enable its survival as a viable state. The Ukraine war has had the perverse effect of increasing Europe's, and especially Germany's, external dependencies. Today, German chemical companies are building some of the world's largest processing plants in China and using Russian gas that they cannot obtain at home. The Trump administration finds itself at odds with European officials who hold unrealistic expectations for the war, perched in unstable minority governments, many of which trample on basic principles of democracy to suppress opposition. A large European majority wants peace, yet that desire is not translated into policy, in large measure because of those governments' subversion of democratic processes. This is strategically important to the United States, precisely because European states cannot reform themselves if they are trapped in a political crisis. And that's probably the best bit out of the whole lot. I mean, I agree with all of that. I think that's, I think he's put that very well, very diplomatically as well. What do you make of this bit, Matt?
Oh, this is what really has gotten European governments absolutely in a furor. We know what's happened in Romania, Moldova, what's happened in Germany, what happened in France a few years ago. Anybody who preaches some kind of nationalism has to be destroyed or arrested or worse. And the obsession, this Crimean War level obsession with destroying Russia. And half these people can't really, if you were to ask them, why do you hate Russia's government so much? They couldn't give you a solid answer or an answer that makes any sense. And there you have the European idea that, you know, they've lost many people there. They can't admit it. Continuing the war, you know, Russia is now the premier military force on the planet. They're absolutely invincible. They're the most battle-hardened, well-supplied group. And you have their industrial complex is state-owned or army-owned, not for profit. So their production has totally outpaced NATO and the U.S. At every turn. And all these articles saying the opposite are nonsense. It's destroyed the German economy. We know that. The sanctions, and now it's gotten far worse. And I kind of like the idea of, and the post-hostilities reconstruction of Ukraine. Well, it's going to be a much smaller Ukraine. It's going to be maybe a non-industrial Ukraine, because the East was where all of the industry was, for the most part. And the fact that, it's not going to be a viable state unless we do this, it's lost so many men. It's been depopulated. These minority governments, it's not just they're opposed to nationalism, they're also violently opposed to Russia. NATO can't win this. Anytime they send equipment there, it's immediately vaporized. These Ukrainians, I can't get into that. I don't want to talk about this book anymore. But, these untrained crews riding what they're told is a tank, which is really just an APC, are just annihilated immediately. German industrial production is awful. Awful. The results have been terrible. And if you read my book, I go into great detail about that. So you see a civilization in utter collapse. And yes, the majority of people want peace. They don't want immigrants there. But they can't translate that into policy, because we have a regime. Individual nation states don't really matter. You have far more powerful entities like BlackRock and former U.S. administrations, and the media and everybody else who really makes policy. But to a great extent, that very last bit there, he's talking about what happened in Romania, anytime, or Germany too, where anytime a right-wing government, nationalist government, makes strides proving that they're popular, they will do anything. They don't care about constitutions or rights or anything to destroy them. There've been arrests. There's been bans. There's whatever it takes. But you know, Ukraine itself is a one-party state. Well, technically, there's four parties that say the exact same thing. Trying to make it look like a multi-party state, but it's identical. And you have bans on the Russian language and everything else. And that's called, democracy by the U.S. Israeli policy in the Middle East is called a democratic. So Trump is trying to bring the definition of democracy back to its actual roots, rather than this perverse use of the term that so many other administrations, especially the Biden administration, have used to simply justify promoting leftist policies. And Germany is probably deindustrialized. I don't believe the numbers that are coming out of their official statistics, because it would cause a revolt, just like I do with the U.S. You have to go elsewhere. There's mass unemployment, and all of this has to do with American demands to destroy Russia. And they not only have they failed, they've made Russia stronger.
It's like these European countries don't seem to understand. They have to be on friendly terms with Russia so that they can get gas at a reasonable price, so that they can fund their economies. If they don't get the gas at a reasonable price, the economy crashes. As Trump says here, all the companies end up moving to China, where they can use the Russian gas at a cheaper price. I mean, Putin gave sweetheart deals to everyone in Europe, was getting a cheaper price for their gas than the rest of the world. And to think that, we just have to keep pressing on with this war, it's not financially possible to do that. It seems to me Trump is the only grown-up in the room by pointing that out. But next, he moves on to the Middle East. For half a century at least, American foreign policy has prioritized the Middle East above all other regions. The reasons are obvious. The Middle East was for decades the world's most important supplier of energy, was a prime theater of superpower competition, and was rife with conflict that threatened to spill into the wider world and even to our own shores. Today, at least two of those dynamics no longer hold. Energy supplies have diversified greatly, with the United States once again a net energy exporter. Superpower competition has given way to great power jockeying, in which the United States retains the most enviable position, reinforced by President Trump's successful revitalization of our alliances in the Gulf with other Arab partners and with Israel. Conflict remains the Middle East's most troublesome dynamic, but there is today less to this problem than headlines might lead one to believe. Iran, the region's chief destabilizing force, has been greatly weakened by Israeli actions since October 7, 2023, and President Trump's June 25 Operation Midnight Hammer, which significantly degraded Iran's nuclear program. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict remains thorny, but thanks to the ceasefire and release of hostages President Trump negotiated, progress towards a more permanent peace has been made. Hamas chief backers have been weakened or stepped away. Syria remains a potential problem, but with American, Arab, Israeli and Turkish support, may stabilize and reassume its rightful place as an integral positive player in the region. As this administration rescinds or eases restrictive energy policies and American energy production ramps up, America's historic reason for focusing on the Middle East will recede. Instead, the region will increasingly become a source and destination of international investment and in industries well beyond oil and gas, including nuclear energy, AI and defense technologies. We can also work with Middle East partners to advance other economic interests, from securing supply chains to bolstering opportunities to develop friendly and open markets in other parts of the world, such as Africa. Middle East partners are demonstrating their commitment to combating radicalism, a trendline American policies should continue to encourage. but doing so will require dropping America's misguided experiment with hectoring these nations, especially the Gulf monarchies, into abandoning their traditions and historic forms of government. We should encourage and applaud reform when and where it emerges organically, without trying to impose it from without. The key to successful relations with the Middle East is accepting the region, its leaders, and its nations as they are, while working together on areas of common interest. America will always have core interests in ensuring that Gulf energy supplies do not fall into the hands of an outright enemy, that the Strait of Hormuz remains open, that the Red Sea remains navigable, that the region not be an incubator or exporter of terror against American interests or the American homeland, and that Israel remains secure. We can and must address this threat ideologically and militarily without decades of fruitless nation-building wars. We also have a clear interest in expanding the Abraham Accords to more nations in the region and to other countries in the Muslim world. But the days in which the Middle East dominated American foreign policy in both long-term planning and day-to-day execution are thankfully over. Not because the Middle East no longer matters, but because it is no longer the constant irritant, a potential source of imminent catastrophe that it once was. It is rather emerging as a place of partnership, friendship and investment, a trend that should be welcomed and encouraged. In fact, President Trump's ability to unite the Arab world at Sharm el-Sheikh in pursuit of peace and normalization will allow the United States to finally prioritize American interests. And I think it's good that he's saying we shouldn't be trying to change these countries and change their traditions. You should just work with them. And if they happen to do something we agree with, then pat them on the back for it. But we certainly shouldn't be telling them that they should have feminism and abortion and pornography and all the other horrors of the West and trying to force it on them at gunpoint. So I agree with him as far as that is concerned. But I think the fact that Israel is at the center of American politics will mean that the Middle East will always be at the center of politics because of that fact, because Israel has such an influence. Matt, what are your thoughts on this bit?
Well, a lot of this, especially the first handful of paragraphs, are based on delusion. Israel is losing that war. Midnight Hammer was a miserable failure. You know, the Iranians, what was it? I forget even when it was. Flattened so many of the institutions of the Israeli military, to the point where you're still not allowed to send pictures of it or videos of it and put it on social media. You can get arrested for that there. Normalization, of course, means ties with Israel. And, of course, you know, the U.S. doesn't get energy from the Middle East, hasn't in a long time. And sometimes I think that even the left does this too. You know, they're against wars for oil. Well, oil's not the issue. There's only one issue there, and that's Israel. Syria, of course, is just like all the other times where the U.S. has tried to overthrow a government using proxies. Sudan, Libya, they're left with absolute chaos. There is no government in Syria right now. American investors may invest in oil industries there. BlackRock, I'm sure, dominates it. And radicalism is usually the fault of the U.S. It's you know, Israel completely, the existence of Israel led to all of these conflicts. You know, Donald Trump, in the very beginning, in the very introduction, the full document says that he is the cause of peace in the Gaza Strip. And we know what nonsense that is. But to believe that oil is the main issue here, superpower competition, is the exact same thing. I don't know why the U.S. has an enviable position. They haven't taken really any action. And by Arab partners, he really is talking about the UAE, maybe Oman, sometimes Saudi Arabia. And the only reason that he wants them not to be interfered with is because they've made their peace with Israel. Syria, Iran, a different story. So, and Iran is not the chief destabilizing force. Israel is, and we know this. And the drive of the regime in the Middle East is to take countries that are either first world themselves, like Iran, or on becoming first world, like Libya and Syria, and bombing them back to the Stone Age. It's really an economic matter. The Iranian economy is still doing relatively well under the circumstances because it has so much Russian and Chinese support and Indian support. It is a first world economy. It's highly scientific. You know, the Israelis have killed, 20 nuclear scientists by now? You know, terrorist actions, which are now normalized. Syria under Assad was fairly prosperous and increasingly prosperous. And despite the U.S. Sanctions, you know, the U.S. trade with Syria isn't substantial. So a lot of this is delusion, and a lot of this, you know, you have to get behind the terms, you know, the diplomatic wording. You know, the Gulf monarchies. Well, he's talking about those who support Israel, and they do so at their own peril. Remember, I just did a paper on this some time ago. United Arab Emirates, for citizens, oil pays for everything. They don't have any bills. They don't have any taxes. Even college, medical, everything is paid for with oil. But unfortunately, only 11% of the population are actually citizens. The rest are Arab serfs who do the hard work, especially Palestinians. The same goes for – it's a little bit higher in Saudi Arabia. And, of course, Libya was a totally different story. That meant for everyone living there was treated the same way. But if you support Israel, it really doesn't matter what you do. You're going to get the support of the U.S. And, you know, the situation, you know, he's skipping over so many other issues, you know, the Gaza slaughter and everything else, trying to pretend that the attack on Iran was a success, when it clearly was not. Even believing that the nuclear program had something to do with weapons, which is a totally, you know, separate issue. And yeah, Israel is so badly overstretched, but it has not done well. Didn't do well in, it was attacking UN bases in Lebanon when it invaded last year. It was solely it was a terroristic invasion. And finally, when they got their act together, they were driven out. They only made it a few miles in. So it's either delusion or just hypocrisy, this whole section. And, but using diplomatic language, you have to know about the issues before you could really decode it.
Well, I guess two out of three aren't bad, are they? China and Europe, they weren't too bad. And it was just this Middle Eastern one that seems a little bit delusional. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion. Talk Radio for the nationalist community.